This is the third reel of a taped interview with Peter McMillan in his home in Perth, Western Australia, on the 9th of the 1st, 2003, for the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. We've obviously been talking about your heading off to the Sudan. Tell us what was involved in that.
Trip to the Sudan was to take us down to 211 Squadron. I think it was 211 or 112, I can't remember now. It was an operational training unit down at a place called Wadi Gazouza in the Sudan. And Wadi Gazouza, the airdrome overlooked the sea on a set of cliffs which must have been pretty close to 1,000 feet high. But that was when we got there. To get there, we had to go to Cairo from our base down in the, very difficult to remember now, in the lake area at the Middle East Pool. We had to go into Cairo, and to get to Cairo we went by train, and that took a long time. I can't tell you how long. It must have been a day and a night. In Cairo, we were then transported down to the river and put aboard a beautiful houseboat, which had accommodation on it for 60 or 70 people. The majority of the people on board were we air crew. There must have been 30 or 40 of us, but there were also a lot of what we used to call Pommy Drongos, which were army fellows, and a number of them were first lieutenants, and a number were captains and majors, and they looked upon us as very poor white trash. We didn't like that very much. We had to mess with them, and they didn't like that at all. They considered that we should be put into a separate mess. And it all started off at the very beginning on a not very good basis at all. It wasn't until a day or so into the journey that we got into an area of the river where we were fairly close to the banks, and there were beautiful views of settlements and lots of beautiful places where they were growing vegetables and fruits, lots of little kids running up and down on the edge, camels and sheep and goats, and a lot of people. And everyone was very interested in these. And then on one of the banks on the other side, there are a lot of crocodiles. These were all drawn up on the sandy beaches, and they had their mouths open, and birds were trotting around inside their mouths, cleaning their teeth. These evoked quite a bit of interest. And it was then that the Drongos began to see that we were interested in the same things that they were, and it sort of broke the ice a bit. One of the majors on board, who I think had a better PR attitude than anyone, produced some rifles and ammunition, and then suggested that we had competitions shooting at objects that were thrown overboard. This started quite an interesting situation, and then somebody produced some of their revolvers, their six shooters, and we all had a go with them, And in the end, it became quite a funny sort of situation where we all mucked in together, and there were we sergeants in the Air Force were palling up with officers of the Army, and it was quite funny. We used to drink together at night, and it was quite an interesting little trip. We got to a place where they were beginning to build the Aswan High Dam. And this was very fascinating because the bloke that was driving the boat took us in close to the shore and showed us these huge carvings of Ramesses or whoever the people were, carved into the side of the cliff. And there were monuments in the actual river itself. I took some pictures of these. They're all underwater now, under the Aswan High Dam. I think we're on the water for pretty close to a week. And then we floated into, I can't remember the name of the place now, it's a big place on the Nile. Silly, can't remember. We were taken off the boat and then transferred to a train. And the train consisted of a whole lot of dog boxy type carriages, and we were all shoveled into these. We lost sight of the Army then, I don't know where they went to. But we spent pretty close on 3 or 4 days on the railway on our way over to the coastline at Wadi Gazouza.
It was obviously, you're talking about an adventure that you wouldn't have had normally, and still, you mentioned earlier on that you were tourists abroad, literally.
That's right, this was really, yeah. It was an amazing thing. It was quite an event, and one that we never ever would have ever had a chance of doing ever. Bit of a wind starting. Our arrival at Wadi Gazouza was quite interesting too, because it was a Royal Air Force squadron, and we were Australians who came from way down under, and we were ignorant so-and-sos. We were led to feel this by quite a number of the people on the station. It wasn't a nice feeling at all, excepting some of the instructors were terrific. And I can't ever remember the senior members of the squadron getting down and being with the mob who were in training. It was a later picture when we actually joined into an operational squadron. The feeling was quite different. The squadron we were on was 211 Squadron, 72 OTU. Now, when we were there, we were introduced to the aircraft we were to train in. They were long-nosed Blenheims. There are two types of Blenheim. The short nose, which was quite a whippy aircraft with twin engines, and they increased the length of its nose, I think, to make its bombay a bit bigger, and they were the ones that we had to train in. We did a couple of flights in a short nose Blenheim with our pilot, and it was much nicer aircraft to flip around in the air in. The long-nosed Blenheim was a bit cumbersome in a way. Now, in order to get organised, we had to make up into crews. And it was here that we didn't know anyone. And the thing was that we Australians, there were Australians, Rhodesians, and funnily enough, there were a couple of Americans there too. But the Australians and the Rhodesians and I got together with a young fella called Merv Scope from Queensland, who was a pilot. And there was another lanky character there called Joe Pearson, who was a navigator. And we chummed up together to form a crew. And from then on, we had to fly together to do our trips to familiarise ourselves with the aircraft. I had to learn how to organise the guns and the wireless. And Joe had to learn his navigational techniques, and Merv had to fly the bloody aircraft. Quite frankly, he was not our best choice as a pilot, but that came much, much later. We had to trust him to begin with. Some of the things that I can remember there were the long-range navigation that we had to do across the countryside, and you could take off from the drone straight out over the sea, and below you was 1,000 feet of straight down to the water from the drone over the cliff edge. You then did a turn to the starboard and reversed course and went out over the country of the Sudan and Ethiopia. Now, in Ethiopia, the Italians had been bombing the hell out of the local inhabitants, and we were warned all the time, don't crash in Ethiopia, because if you do, you'll be grabbed by the locals and you will be operated on, and your testicles will be put in your mouth and you'll be laid out on an ant's nest. And all these sort of terrible things were told to us, so we didn't like doing that much, but we were given out areas to fly, and so we had to do it. We put our trust in the aircraft, and most of the time the motors worked very well. One of the nice things was you could get down fairly low, and we used to hunt out packs of animals in the foresty or open forest country. We came on herds of gazelles and other quite big creatures, some of which I can't remember what they are, but there were native animals all over the place. From the work that we did, learning to navigate and use the aircraft and wireless op and all the rest of it, we then went over to formation flying, and this was where I didn't like it at all, and quite frankly, I ended up a wreck, plus the aircraft. Our effort on this occasion, we took off in a Vic of 3. The leading aircraft was a short-nosed Blenheim, and we were on its port. That's on its right side, and it's we were on its starboard side, that side. In the process of flying, the bloke flying the short-nosed Blenheim gave instructions to the aircraft flying with him, telling him to tuck in, tuck in, tuck in. And that meant that you had to bring your wings in as close as you could to the leading aircraft. Merv tucked in a little bit too far and stuck his port engine into the starboard wing of the leader of the Vic. He peeled away the leader, minus about 6 feet off the end of his wing, disappeared down back to the drone, which was about 20 miles away in the distance. Our aircraft, the port engine, was on fire, and there's a switch inside the aircraft thing called Gravener switch, which when you activate it, it squirts liquid, I think it was carbon dioxide, into the burning area, and he did put the fire out. It smouldered, but it put it out. He couldn't feather the prop. Feathering the prop would have helped, because it meant that there wasn't all that much drag on that dud engine. The starboard engine was working very well, but we were losing height rapidly. We were offered the chance of bailing out, but then we thought of what would happen if we were caught, so we decided to stick with the aircraft. That was Jay Pearson and myself. Merv said he was going to fly the plane back to the drone. So we steadily lost height, and I had to lower my turret down to stop drag. We just sat there in trepidation, waiting to get to the drone. It was on the edge of the drone that Merv said he could not get the wheels down and we would have to land on our belly. Fair enough. So we came in for a crash landing on our belly. A hell of a cloud of dust, a roaring sort of screeching horrible mess, and fire. I looked up when the aircraft stopped and there was a wall of flame shooting down the middle of the aircraft towards where I was sitting. I banged the stud that opened the door to get out of the top of the aircraft, and luckily it flew open, and I dived out over the edge and got out of the aircraft, which was really firing up. I looked up on the wing. There was Joe Pearson crawling out of his section of the cockpit. I went up and helped him out, and then we both had to get down and undo Merv's scope out of his harness and drag him out. He had pranged his head on landing, and I think he was a bit dopey. And we all scrambled down off the aircraft and ran away as far as we could from it when the whole thing exploded. That was my introduction to formation flying, thank you very much. After that, I was never very, very happy flying in formation ever.
How did you feel about being the air crew at this point?
We thought it was marvellous. It was marvellous to be a member of the crew and to have an aircraft to barge around the countryside in, to be able to fire one's gun in the air without fear or favour, to be able to be a member of the crew and to be able to discuss things with the other two about what we were doing and where we were going, and they would tell us the pilot would tell us what was happening, and the navigator would keep giving us points of information as we went along. In other words, we were a close little tiny community up there in the aircraft. It was good. And even after the prank, it was fine. After the prank, we were picked up and toted back to the operations office, where there was a fella sitting behind a desk with a couple of stripes on his shoulders, a flight leery. I was feeling very droggy. My arms had been very badly burnt, and I hadn't got much left on my face. And I felt very sick indeed, and so I slid down and sat on the floor. I couldn't do anything else. There was a roar and a scream, and this bastard behind the desk stood up and said, "Stand to attention, you ignorant so-and-so." Merv and Joe Pearson helped me to my feet, and I stood and leant against the wall. And he kept saying, "Stand up straight." And Terry, the doctor, came in at that stage and said, "This man is not fit at the moment. I'm going to take him away to treat him." And the fellow carried on like an idiot. I've got his name, and I've never ever forgotten that so-and-so, a typical RAF ignorant bastard. I was taken away and given painkillers and wrapped up in all sorts of things on my arms and over my face. We were in the air again an hour later, flying in bloody formation again. And that was done to restore our confidence, which in a way was a good thing. If we hadn't have done that, we would have thought, well, we'll never ever take off and be happy again. I want to stop that. That's right. After that, formation flying, when we did formation flying, we were never told to tuck right in. It suited me. In fact, it suited everybody. We used to do formation flying bombing, and the bombing consisted of practice bombs, and you had to drop the bombs on particular targets that had been selected. It was done in formation, or it was done solo. One of the other things we had to do was to... We were given a plot out at sea, and we had to fly out over the Gulf to this area, and when we got there, we had to signal back to base that we had arrived at this area and hold the radio key down for 10 seconds. Now, to do this, in doing this, the stations on shore, and there were two of them, they could get what they call a fix on us. And that would mean that we were sending out our signal at that point and they'd get a fix. If the fix didn't match up with where we were supposed to be, we got a rocket. I don't think we ever got a rocket. It showed what a good operational navigator that we had. It was about this stage that Mr. Marconi came into the situation. We were issued with new Marconi sets in the aircraft, and they were absolutely beautiful, except they had a drawback, and nobody had ever told anybody about it. The wireless ops were given the opportunity of using these beautiful sets, so off we went. They worked wonders, and they had a magic eye that you could tune, and the magic eye told you when you were on the particular frequency required. And a couple of 20 or 30 minutes out from base, we worked very well, and then all of a sudden the set went dud, finish, no joy. So we had to return to base and complain that the set wasn't working. It wasn't only us, there were quite a number of aircraft, the same thing happened. When we landed, there was a silly little man came running up. He was the bloke in charge of the wireless operation area. And he said, "Why didn't you turn the mains on?" And he said, we were never told about any mains. And he leant down and showed us a tiny little switch behind the bloody set that we had to switch on that was connected to the main batteries of the aircraft. After that, we and all the other blokes never had any problems with Marconi sets.
How did they make your job easier?
In the old one, we had T-1080s, I think they were called, and RT-1081s. They were old-fashioned sets that we had used in training back in Australia. They had valves which were about nearly a foot high, and they took ages to warm up. And what was more, if the aerial got any muck on it at all, you couldn't get a decent signal out. You couldn't tune the set in so that it was absolutely spot on all the time. It was a struggle, but we managed with them. It was when we got the other sets that things began to be really good, and it was a very efficient sort of situation.
What were you hearing about the outside war and how that was going?
Well, while we were there, we heard the Japanese were causing big problems. It must have been Pearl Harbor had been happening, and the Pacific was being got at. And we felt very strongly about this, and our agitation in this regard was such that we pushed and pushed and pushed for us to be sent back to Australia. The RAF wouldn't have it. They said, you've been sent here to work with us, you stay with us. So we had to.
So you've heard of things like Greece and Crete and Tobruk and...
Yep.
Obviously, Tobruk had fallen. Serious situation.
Yeah.
What were the feelings in relation to how the war was going, either your way or not?
Well, we weren't happy in the fact that we went up there being in on things. A lot of our mates had gone up there and were flying with squadrons, and we wanted to be up there too. It was a sort of backwards and forwards situation up in the desert. I think it was before Rommel turned up on the war. We were hearing that there were big problems with the way the Germans were coming down towards Egypt, and that they were having a job to keep them at bay. But they were doing it, but they were having a hell of a big problem.
One of the problems I've heard about, and people talk about the lack of air support.
That's right. That's true. That we did not have the aircraft, but we didn't know that at the time. We knew we had our Blenheims, we could use them. Oh, thank God we didn't.
Why?
Because really they weren't all that crash hot. They were pretty bloody slow. And the turret was an awful turret to defend the back of the aircraft with. Had twin guns, and it was worked by bicycle pedals. You had to sit there and pedal the bloody turret to go around. It wasn't exactly a magnificent sort of situation at all. I forget how long we were there. I could look up in the logbook and find all that out, but
December of 41, obviously the Japanese are coming in, so you're presumably around about this time thinking of what's going on around you.
Yeah.
In relation to the Japanese, what stories were you hearing?
Well, we were just hearing that they were mowing everybody down and getting their own way in the air. They were just absolutely massacring things.
What had been their reputation prior to this?
And we didn't know. I didn't know that. Really didn't. We did know that they were right proper bastards, the way they treated local people and the way they treated the Chinese and the awful things they did. They were massacring whole populations and not bothering about anybody that got in their way. We realised what horrible people they could be.
I'm interested, you mentioned the Italians and the experience with them. You've heard stories of the Germans and now the Japanese. The Germans, how did they sort of rate between the three of them?
Well, quite frankly, the Japanese didn't rate anywhere with us because we weren't going there. It was the Germans that were our worry, and the German Air Force was our big worry. One of the big worries was the German Air Force, the fighters. And we had to do a lot of practice in the air using our guns to ward off imaginary fighters.